Yeah, that's the point of the Holocaust jokes or any jokes. The Jews kind of make light of a topic. But that's your point, right? What's your name again? Yeah.
Matthew,
yeah. So yeah, that do mean it. Right, it kind of trivializes the event. The idea of a joke is like making light of something. And if you really appreciate it, like again, if it would be someone, a close friend of yours whose dad was tortured or something in real life, you know, you'd never do such a thing because it's insensitive. It means you don't like appreciate what the thing is. So I think the idea of the joke about it is kind of an attempt, like in a certain sense, like an attempt to, it means you're not taken seriously, and it's probably like a part of it. It's like, I would think, why do you make a joke about it? It could be like a part of it is like, it's a scary thing, the Holocaust, you know? Like, the part of you must be frightened by the whole idea of it. It's like a crazy thing that something like that could happen. And when you make light of something, it's kind of like trying to deny it, to turn away from it, to pretend like it's like, you know, instead of like treating it as a serious topic and something that you want to, like, that's scary and like something that, you know, reminds you of the fact that we're, you know, we are like terrible things like that do happen. So you make light of it and it kind of like pushes under the carpet like it can't happen. But it's definitely like denying the underlying reality that it did happen. That's a tragedy and it's terrible, you know? So, yeah, I think definitely.
Yeah, it's kind of like a way people cope with how, like,
yeah.
You know,
basically how it happened. Yeah, right, exactly, to cope with it. But I think we can't, it's in a certain sense it's like denying it though, because if it's really real to you, you'd never ever do something like that. So it's like an attempt to make light of it and kind of to pretend, it like makes it like it's not real, because if it was real, you'd never be able to say something like that, you know? So it's like a way, instead of coping with it by facing it, like we have a mitzvah to like to remember what Amalek did to us and to remember things like this and to think and to study, like we have a mitzvah of like studying Amalek and studying Risha, studying Hitler, realize people could do crazy things like this. There's such a thing as rishus, and it could happen, and it could happen anywhere. It's the kind of thing we have to be aware of. We have to recognize, study the evil in man to understand it. And, you know, I think that's like part of the problem is like with these, like part of the reason why I think people don't understand, like we try, like these, like for instance, America tries to negotiate with, like for instance nowadays, Ahmadinejad, you know, or like these crazy guys who people think we could just negotiate with and talk to them and reason with them and be, you know, reasonable. Like, people don't understand that the crazy mentality. Like, you kind of think they're one of us. But if you see Nazism, you see these guys are crazy. They're totally, but crazy. Like, they're rishas, they're rishayim. And a man is capable of the worst things. And you can't, it's important to look at them and to study the events and to understand, you know, to take lessons from events like that. But to make light of it kind of makes it as if it's, you know, undermines the ability to do such a thing, you know?
If I may say so, it seems to me that a better term to use of that type of mentality is not crazy, but rather evil.
Yes, that's true.
Which is much more
appropriate. Yeah,
I really think more accurate.
You're right. It's true. It's not crazy. Crazy is like
say
a
crazy. He's insane.
No. You're right.
Our society.
Yeah.
That means mentally ill. Therefore, yes. He lets him off the hook.
Yeah, you're right. No, you're right. Excellent point. It's
so
true.
We have to be careful with the terminology.
Mm-hmm. True.
Not just
right.
In this subject, but in any
yes.
Subject.
Yeah, you're right.
Other examples would be occupation, and in that connection, the so-called West Bank. Yeah, right. Be careful with the terminology
yeah,
you use.
It's true. True, excellent. Yep.
Yeah, who is a Amalek exactly? What qualifies for being a Amalek?
That's a good question. So I think they say Rav Chaim held. I mean, I think it was Rav Chaim's Chiddush, is that Amalek doesn't just mean a particular genealogy. But he held it's an ideology. So, and I think, I don't really know that well. I could say what I've heard Rebbe say. You know, something like any nation whose, like, mission is, stands for, like, the destruction of the Jew. You know, and I think it's highly related to, like, it's like a deification of man. Again, you see, for instance, Haman. Everyone bowed to Haman. You know, it was like a thing, like, he deified himself. And when a person deifies himself, so the Jew is a threat. Because the Jew basically says there's no such thing as this, you know, God, ultimate glorial and is everything, and any human being is nothing, you know. So the idea is that the underlying downfall for someone who deifies himself is the Jewish nation, who says your whole system is corrupt and says that man is lowly. So that it's like a natural. Just give me 1 second. Hi. You can't hear me. Okay, I'll play closer. Yeah, so like a natural consequence of someone of the philosophy of deifying themselves is going to be like part of their mission is going to be to destroy the Jew. You know, like remember like Haman said, every single time I see Mordechai and it doesn't bow down to me, I say, like, I want to, it's all worth nothing. You know, kol zayin ein shavli, it's all worth nothing. So, like, the idea is that when you have the ideology of, it's a combination, I think, of the ideology of deifying man and therefore denying God, denying the Jew. So that's like the, you know, for instance, the Nazis were a big time of like the master race, making, you know, the German people, it was like deifying man, and there, and you know, side by side with that is the extermination of the Jew. So I don't know, I think I've heard Rebbe say, like, he says, like, the current day, like, you know, Arabs, those guys, those guys are Amalek, you know? But I don't really, like, have a well-defined, you know? I think the idea is, though, it is an ideology. It's not just like, a guy who's, like, any Russia is just Amalek, but it's some sort of, like, ideology which is antithetical to a Jew. Yeah, let me see. I'm on speaker. Does he hear me better now? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I have a Chumash question.
Okay.
So, it seemed like Yaakov made the decision that he saw that Yosef was, for whatever reason, the one that was destined to be the leader of the brothers.
Right.
But later on, it kind of seems as if, especially because he was sold and he wasn't with them, that he sort of lost that role, and it seems like Yehuda kind of stepped forward up and took that.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, like, in the Brachos, Yaakov, he tells Yosef that he gets a double portion, and the Mefarshim say that that's because he got the title of the Bechor.
Right.
So just, like, how would you reconcile that, and also the fact that it seems like it would be difficult for Yosef to really, like, lead the brothers when he wasn't with them for all those years, and you know, also even once they got back, it seemed like there was still like a sort of disconnect between them,
between Yosef and the brothers.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible to say that Yaakov was just wrong?
I mean, did you read Yehuda's bracha by Yaakov?
Yes,
I did. Okay, then it should be clear.
I think it's clear.
You want to elaborate, Chaim?
I don't know. I thought it said something about Yehuda being in the lead.
It doesn't mean, you definitely see that, like, in the future generations, like, Yehuda's descendants take on a leadership role. But, like, in terms of the brothers themselves, like, it seems like, at least, like, Yaakov still considered Yosef to...
Right. Well, Yosef just practically in Mitzrayim, I mean, he was the leader, he supported them, he was, like, leader of Mitzrayim as all, so, like, he was just... I mean, it seems like Yaakov held that he was the, like, the philosophical leader, so to speak, the greatest chacham.
Right.
And he was the one who had the greatest insight and the greatest knowledge of Torah, and practically it ended up he was the one who physically would be their leader also. So, I mean, you're saying because afterwards you see that they kind of thought, you know, they like suspected Yosef. So you're saying afterwards?
Yeah, it seems like difficult for him to really like be the leader of the brothers when it doesn't, you know, seem like there was like some sort of...
Well, I guess the question is like this. It's like, what do you need to be a leader? So if you have like a nation, a movement, which is essentially like a camaraderie, and it's about some sort of social intermingling and that type of thing, so then someone who's away from them for many, many years, you're going to say it's hard for them to take on that new position, because socially they have so many memories and all the palling around they did all the years, and you kind of missed out on it, you know? And so far as the nature of the brothers were a nation devoted towards building Klal Yisrael, and like the Shvatim and the whole ideology of what they were, so then the leader of their group, he'd be able to fit in because he's the greatest of them, and despite the fact that he was away, he was still Yosef HaTzadik, and he's still in all his greatness, and he was the appropriate leader for, you know, he's the appropriate leader for the people. So it seemed like, I don't see why that would take away just because he was apart from them for all those years, as long as he remained in his Zidkas, which seems like
so
he
did.
Do
you think that they recognized that he was on that level?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he put them through the whole thing, the whole way he even orchestrated that whole thing and brought them to Tshuva. That was, you know, that whole job is that whole story of the brothers going down, and, you know, how he, you know, called them spies, and he got them to bring Binyamin, and that whole thing was all a matter of a process of getting them to do Tshuva. And he brought about the Tshuva then, that they basically had, like, Binyamin, who was, they related to as, like, now Yaakov's new favorite, and you see now Yehuda risked his life for Binyamin. They kind of had a they kind of went through the same situation as they previously were in, but now with Binyamin, and it was an opportunity for them to do tshuva, and they did. So they saw now Yosef orchestrated this whole thing, and how they basically, so there was like a kind of a rift because of the old event or whatever, but Yosef did everything he could to knock that out. But he was still their leader philosophically, and the leader, he was the greatest of them.
Right, so what would, there's another aspect, this I guess is a little bit more questionable, but it seems like one of the ideas, of the brachos, and seems like an idea of, Torah, is that you see that in someone's descendants,
right,
that they embody certain qualities that their forefathers have.
Right.
And a lot of the brachos are detailing and laying out the structure and, the way that the Shvatim would exist. And I guess it just seems odd to me that if Yosef really had this leadership role and was on a certain level above them, that the political leadership was reserved for Yehuda, then the Torah went to Levi. It seems like...
Yeah.
You don't see Yosef's greatness embodied in his descendants as much.
It's true. I know, you see Menashe and Ephraim are two Shvatim, but at the same time...
And then politically, Ephraim was very important. But
so Yeshua being from Ephraim is not...
But in the future, the whole, the ultimate, the Malchus is from Yeshua, from Yehuda. It's true, you take a study.
Yisrael is from Ephraim also.
Okay. But that was because of the Chet. That was also because of the Chet. Essentially, it was supposed to be Yehuda.
Right, but I'm saying, Malchus Yisrael is still Ephraim.
It's true, Malchus Mashiach is from David and Shlomo and Shevet Yehuda. It's a good question. I don't know. It's really take analysis of the. It's a good, interesting question. It's like the relative roles of Yosef and Yehuda. It's a good. I'd have to look into it more. That's an excellent question. I don't know if off the cuff you guys say anything. Yeah, I think.
How do we look at Malchut in general? Interesting because in this parasha, everybody looks at it as Yehuda, he's pronouncing Yehuda as the king, and I forgot exactly which parasha, but we say it seems like it's kind of not such an ideal.
Idea of a king.
Yeah. So .
It's a good question. It's a good question. Whether a king is a good thing or a bad thing.
Right, or even.
I think there's a big discussion in the Rishon about that, I think.
About whether it's
a mitzvah or it's... Because it is one of the mitzvahs in the Torah, is the point of the king,
What? The Rambam?
Rambam has it as a mitzvah, yeah.
Is it one of those things that you need, or is it just there because it was going to come about anyway?
That's a good question. Well, originally by that parasha, by Shmuel, I haven't really analyzed it in depth, but I think the problem there is that they said they want a king like all the nations around them. So what they were looking for is, they had a Navi, and a Navi is like someone who gives them knowledge from God, and he was their leader. It's like he's a great Chacham, and he receives knowledge from God. And what they wanted, though, they wanted the security of a king. A king is a certain, powerful figure who you could kind of rely on and hang your hat on, he's a certain, powerful king. And they think that was the problem. Is they say we want a king like all the other nations. And that's what Shmuel said, is that instead of they had the Navi, and instead of turning to the Navi and getting their security from God through the person of the Navi, they were looking for a powerful, powerful human leader to be the strong force who's going to, But they did get it. That's what God said basically through Shmuel. Is that this is what they need. If they need it, they need it. He basically said, it's true, it's a chait for that. It seems like it was a chait for them asking at that time. But I think the way they say it is because they were asking incorrectly. They were asking as, because they wanted to be like the other nations.
Yeah,
but I don't know if it's halachli chukas agayim. I think it's just that their motivation was improper.
Yeah,
But even from the even where it says directly in the Pasukim, like about the king, it seems like. I mean, there's a way to read it, I guess.
That seems that it's bad or that it's good?
That's not a good thing.
In the mitzvah, you mean? Where it says, and show you, like, where is it? Ready, show them, and you want to go to the farm, please?
Not. Okay. No, not.
Wait, in Shmuel or in Chumash? Yeah.
Yeah, what do you want?
The farm. Or if there's a farm that goes with those there? Or the big one, whatever you got. Either way.
The one?
Yeah, whatever you got. It'll be easier for me to find the king.
I have just a side question here about kings.
Kings, okay.
I've seen texts that refer to Moshe as a king.
Yeah, I think that's true. But he'd be sure of Malach, they say there's a reference, one side is a reference to Moshe Rabbeinu.
Also, the seven kings of Edom, the Jews had a king.
Therefore what? Why are you mentioning that, John?
Me?
Yeah. The kings of Edom.
So there's two ways of understanding that. You could say... I think it's a little more difficult, but you could say that it's a nevuah that there would be seven kings from Edom before Shaul would be the Melech,
right.
Or that Moshe really had the title of Melech, and those seven kings were before
really?
The Jews had Moshe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know. That. It means that implies that that's openly saying he was a king.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Matthew. You're saying it's Kisavo la'aretz asher shem kachanosin lach, yirish tov yishavta ba. So you go into Eretz Yisrael. Amarta, Sima alai Melech kechal hagoyim asher sevivosai. I put it, give us a king like all other nations. Son tosim alcha Melech, asher yivchar shem alkecha bo. Nikar b'chacha tosim alcha Melech. Yeah.
That sounds like what they did.
Sounds like what they did, exactly.
Yeah. What's the criticism?
I know. It sounds like if they say this, Amarta. I know, it is funny.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I know. It's like, if they say it, then... I seem to remember it's a machlokas. It's like machlokas and Shana, whether it's like a good thing. Hey, you want to grab a chair from the dining room? Yeah, whether it's like a good thing, or it's like a b'diavad if they need it.
Right.
It's interesting how it's like, I think they say it's like a king is a double-edged sword. The problem is a king is also a big danger of the king himself becoming corrupt. Because
right.
He's like this also this ultimate power.
Like, even like ideally though, I mean I was thinking that like it seems like I mean because we're looking at like from a history and we see like, you know, how it's like so many kids are corrupted, like, you know, it kind of like influences yeah. like our perception
it's
of like
true.
A thing. So
it's true.
I was saying even like if it was like ideally if like there was a king and an actual power that was like that had Yirat Hashem, and like,
yes.
And that, I mean, that could be a very efficient
system. Yes, yeah, like Shlomo Melech. Right. Like, I think that's, or David Melech, for instance, is the ultimate king, you know, and he was a great role of Melech Mashiach. But I think the ultimate Melech reflects Machas Hashem. The highest level Melech, he carries around the Torah with him all day. There's a lot of checks
right.
on the Melech, because the Melech is such a danger of a Vilti Rum of Avo Me'achav and like getting to his head and him feeling like he's the man.
Right.
But he's not the man, he's just sort of like, leader of Am Yisrael, and he's the one who they look to, but he reflects Malchus Hashem, and he carries around the Torah with him, and he's the highest, you know. So far as he embodies the model of greatness, of perfection of the Torah, like Malach Mashiach, then it's great, you know. And that's why the Malach Mashiach is Mashiach means anointed. So the idea of like a king, it's interesting ideas, but like a king is almost like doesn't want to be called anointed, because like anointed points to the one who anointed him, but like a king, it's like he's the man. So the idea of Mashiach is he's Nimshin, he's appointed, you know, and anointed by God. So like, I think the idea is ultimately the proper king should rule the nation and judge the... First of all, I think halacha has two functions. One is, I think, to fight wars. I think that's what the Rambam has.
Right,
to fight the wars, or the Rambam has to fight wars and to judge the people.
And to Malik.
Malik?
And then Shrei Malik.
Maybe that comes under the wars, that's a separate thing.
I think it's
by
the words of Hashem.
I think it's by the words. Now, you want
to
grab me the Shoftim?
Yeah.
Amma. Man, you got the hot seat there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's three mitzvahs when they entered the land. Melech, destroy Amalek, and build a bias. Okay, now one second. Oh, there it says. He asked that question. Given that it's a mitzvah to appoint the king, so why didn't God want them to have a king when they asked for it? The fisha shalu b'tarumos. They argue they asked for it in like complaints. The lo shalu l'kayim mitzvah. They didn't. It wasn't to be kind of mitzvah. Elam neisha katzu b'shmuel navi. Shneimar ki lo osamalasu kiyam osim asa. So they were disgusted with the navi. Like a navi is like I guess they had certain problems with the navi. It wasn't like what they wanted. Of course, they were disgusted with it bothered them, the Navi Hashem, therefore they were asking for a king. So it was like in the wrong mindset. But the idea, apparently, what I'm saying is intrinsically, the Malach is a good idea. If you did it for the mitzvah, then it would be good. Hold on 1 second, let me find the other part. I know he does say somewhere what the point of the malchus is, right? That you know where that is? You're familiar with that, right? He says like a malach is for the purpose of doing something. He has like three things. I think it's like to fight the wars of God.
Is that the first thing? Is that the
first? I thought it was the first thing, but it doesn't say it. No, I don't think it's the first thing. Yeah, I don't know. I know there is something that says that, but I can't remember. I think it's also he does justice. He he's Yishalma, the ultimate die, you know, carried out justice for Klai Yisrael. But he could like bring about the ultimate society. He's like part of the ultimate society of Klai Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. Is with a melech who brings the people towards the Avodas Hashem.
Right.
That's the model, and that's the mitzvah. But so far as you're doing it because you want like the security in a person, then that's not good. You know, it's interesting. It's like a double-edged sword. It seems.
Right.
Seems like you see right many, many, many corrupt kings. I've recently been going through Malachim. It's crazy how many. You know, most of them were really corrupt.
Right.
You know, but some of them were not.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I mean, you see, the Torah has many mitzvahs on a melech to try to keep him in line.
Right.
You know? Because it seems like there's a big danger of it getting, you know, him getting out of control.
Right.
Power corrupts.
Yeah.
Nice question.
Yeah.
That's
a good question, Matthew.
What's the story with, like, brachos in general in the Torah?
Brachos.
I guess maybe the paradigm case is, like, Yaakov and Esav. So, like what did... What did Yitzchak do when he, like...
Blessed
them.
Yeah,
when he blessed them. It's like, one time, it's just, like, a nevuah.
Right.
It doesn't really seem like that from the second.
Right.
Like, why would Esav be so upset if he didn't get the first breath? Like, if it's a nevuah, it's going to happen anyway.
Right.
So, like, what are you mad about? You said you didn't know about it first?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not just a nevuah, it sounds like it's, like, effective in some way.
Yeah.
Like, whoever was standing in front of him at the time that he gave
right.
the breath
mm-hmm.
had some positive... effect based upon those words. So like, how does that work?
Right.
So like it's fila.
Mm-hmm.
And, like if so, he can't be like kozer and say like I messed up the first time. I actually meant to give.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Very good question. Brachos.
Yeah.
And what's the role of brachos nowadays?
Can you bless somebody nowadays?
Yeah.
Is it effective at all?
Right.
It'd be like being a spala for somebody, I guess. Like,
yeah, right, but it doesn't seem like it's exactly a tefillah,
right?
Right. It seems like it's something
you
other.
You have a right to just be like a spala too, just like outside of tefillah
and
just like, start freestyling
about.
Does it come up in the Gemara?
I feel like
it's the Sechus.
It's
the whole
Sechus.
Yeah. There's two funny stories of the Rav, bracha stories. So I think they're the Rav. So one of them was, he said, this woman brought to the Rav his daughter, her son or something. I don't know, he said, could you give him a bracha? He said, what is he, an apple? And then the other one, I think he said, my son's going to Israel. Could you give him a bracha? He said, have a nice trip. And then there was another one. This is a Ramosha. This is a joke, but it's also, I think it helps get to the idea of, I'm not just making jokes here, but this gets to the idea of what bracha is, I think, is that, it was, I guess someone told me, they knew this story personally, that they brought, there was some guy who was like, he was getting old, on the old side, and he wasn't married, you know? So they brought him to Rav Moshe to, like, I guess it was to give him a bracha that he'd get married. I think that was pshat, you know? Moshe Feinstein. And I think Rav Moshe turned to him, gave him a look, he said, no, maybe be a little less picky. And I think the guy ended up getting married or something. So I forget that story goes, but that's how the story should end. I don't know if it happened or not, but you know. But I think the idea of a bracha, and we'll get to that case as a hard case. But the basic idea, the Yaakov and Esav case, that's a tricky case. But I think the basic idea of a bracha is like, it's like advice. It sort of basically is like you're giving a person guidance in their life, direct their life. Like that case from Moshe. Moshe basically, I guess he knew the guy a little bit, they told him a little bit of the guy, and I guess he had a sense that the guy was not getting married, not because whatever, because he was too picky. So it's like, there's an idea is that a person, a gadol, especially like your rebbe, someone who knows you well, could give you a bracha, and first of all, he could give you insight, and also this power, the suggestion of the, you know, he could put you in a certain mindset. Like if Moshe tells a guy like that, he may be thinking down the back of his head, but maybe I'm telling you something, could cause you to think into it, and it can cause you to direct your life in a certain way. So give a bracha, you should become a gatam chacham. You know, so it makes a person, that can impact the person. He could think that's an important value, and he could think into it. And like the situation of having someone who you respect giving you a bracha could give, you know, could guide you in a certain path that could help, you know, something to that. It could be also a tefillah and combined with it. It's like, it's a tefillah, but the nature of the tefillah is the Torah is giving you advice. So it impacts you insofar as, like, it could be there's a double effect, you know, that he's being misfalah, you'll be a big Talmud Chacham, but the idea of him giving you, it's not just called the tefillah, it's called the bracha, because he says it to you, is that he's kind of giving you you know, a message.
He's like separately misfalah, or like what?
No, it could be like part of the thing. It's like Hashem should make you a big Talmud Chacham, or something like that. It could be, that's usually the way these things are said, you know, that Hashem should, you know. God should make you like Ephraim and Asher. So I know you have to see why I'm Ephraim and Asher, but you see, that's like a tefillah. People say God should make you like Ephraim and Asher. So it shows them a role model of Ephraim and Asher. It brings to your kids' mind the model of Ephraim and Asher, shows them how they should, gives them something to aspire to, and at the same time it's a tefillah, because you're being spelled that they should be able to be that way. So there is a tefillah that way, and maybe God's a shmeir tefillah that will help it happen. But it's also the fact that they're in on it, and they hear it, and they're moved, and they could, you know, take the advice and, you know, make it a reality. Yeah, I have to get to your Yaakov and Esav question, but yes.
I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, even when Hashem kind of when tells Abraham, tells Yitzchak, you know, like, when he says, like, you know, you're going to be a fruitful nation,
right? Right.
Like, is that something... It seems like the same kind of concept in terms of, like, it doesn't seem like it's a given. It doesn't seem like it's saying, like, mm-hmm. that's going to happen to you. It seems like, because it seems like, you know, because they're always worried about sinning. Like, it's
right. It's true. Well, that's what I think is good, is that, see, the advice, see, that's the thing, is there's a little bit of a difference in advice when it comes to them, because they had nevuah and they were, like, involved, directly involved in Ashkacha, and maybe, like, a modern-day situation. Right. But in that situation, the advice is based upon nevuah. And it's like this is what I think is, like, part of the thing is that the advice could be, this is a path that you should take up, you know, and you should become a great nation. And but it doesn't, I think I've heard Rebbe talk about this, but it's not like a guarantee. It's not saying it's like, this is definitely going to happen. That's what you're picking up on. Because they're always afraid. What do you mean? Right. They have the bracha. But I think it's like, it's a path of advice which they should pursue. And so far as they use their bechir properly, then this is a proper path.
Right.
You know, so back to the Yaakov and the Esav thing is like, the path originally, see, I think originally the plan, this is the way Rabbi helps out about it, but basically the original plan of Yitzchak, the way he understood it, is that he says he knew that Yaakov was the Ishtam, the guy who sat in the base of Medrash, and he knew that Esav wasn't the guy who was sitting and learning all day long. You know, but his he misjudged Esav, and he thought Esav was a guy who was like a physical guy, and he was involved in like hunting and all that. But he thought he'd use it l'shem shemayim. He knew he wasn't. Not every guy. Torah doesn't hold every guy as a guy who sits and learns all day. That's not normal. It's not every person isn't like that, and not every person is capable of that. Some people are people who need to go out into the world and hunt, and but that doesn't mean that there's a perfection for every person on their level based upon their nature. So some people are guys who could sit and have that and have the energy to sit and learn all day. Other people can't do that and they go out into the world, but their perfection isn't so far as they learn at night or they do whatever it is and they're involved in Stakhar and they're involved in supporting Torah and they're involved in, you know, learning and involved in Torah on their level. So they're different people. So Yitzchak knew that that Esav wasn't Yaakov Avinu, but he thought that Yitzchak was, he basically, this is, he had this idea that they would be like a 1-2 team. That basically, like, Yaakov would be the guy sitting and learning in the Beis Medrash, and Esav would be the guy out in the world fighting and conquering and hunting and supporting.
Like
Yisrael Zvulun type of thing, exactly. You know, it's like, it's not exactly like whatever Zvulun, but it's the same kind of idea, exactly. Like, it would be, they would function, his image of the future of Chal Yisrael would be Yaakov and Esav working together. You know, the Yaakov involved in Torah, and the Esav involved in the supporting the Torah and enabling Yaakov's Torah. But that was a mistake on his part. You know, the Nevuah really had in store what God's real plan was: Esav was a Rasha, and basically Yaakov, you know, had to be involved in both. He had to be involved in going with Lavan and working for 22 years and fighting to be able to make his money and to support himself. It wasn't the plan that he just sits back and learns and Yeshiva and, you know, and Esav takes care of him. Yaakov had to be involved in building the nation himself, in the physical and in the terms of the ideas. So the Nevuah was the guidance through Hashem. See, that's what I say, like, when we would guide, we don't have Nevuah, so our guidance is basically through the mind of a given Chacham. But when Yaakov Yitzchak is doing it, it's through Nevuah. You know, and the Nevuah is basically God's guidance to Yaakov. And Yaakov needs his guidance. What's Yaakov supposed to do? What's his proper path in life? Is his path in life to go and work for Lavan for 22 years? Is his path in life to go to Yeshiva and hope things are going to get taken care of by Esav? Like, as the Nevuah gives you an insight into the proper path that a person should take. And that was, like, I remember Rebbe said, this is in this shiur he gave about this, he said, like, every person has to decide on a path of their life. And he says, some person could decide to go into becoming a Rav. And that's not necessarily good for him. It could turn out, you could look back, that was bad for him. The guy would have been better if he would have put his energies in a different world, you know, area. Maybe he would have been a Rosh Yeshiva instead of, like, a Rav of a shul. Maybe a different guy would have been better to go into business and to be able to support Torah like that. And, like, there's different decisions a person has to make in their life. And it's not always easy to know what's proper for you and what's going to end up in the long run being the best life for you. It's not always the best thing is just sit and learn all day. I mean, some guys aren't going to be able to do it. They're going to not be productive. They're not going to, you know, they can be more productive in learning if they get a job and be able to learn a few hours at night as opposed to just sitting, you know, sitting trying to push themselves to do something that's not in their capability. So, in general, a person needs guidance as the proper path that is best for them in life.
That guy gets as much closer as someone who would learn all day.
I'm not saying that. I don't think it's about trying to get as much schus as you could get as the other guy. I mean, you have to basically, you're living your life, and you have to live the proper life for yourself and the best life for yourself. So God works out judging people, and, you know, each person is judged on his own level. You know, and I don't think, I mean, it's a different discussion. I mean, I don't think we say that a person who's like a plain, simple guy who's learning Torah at night is getting the same star as Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't think that's the case, but that doesn't mean the plain, simple guy should become Moshe Rabbeinu, because it's not possible. So it's not helpful to compare yourself to some other guy and say, I want to get his star. You're not him. You're you. So if you try to push yourself to be doing what he does, look, if you could, then it's great. And then it would be, you know, something you should do. But if you can't, then to force yourself to do something that's not in line with your nature and you're not going to be able to be productive, then that's, you're not going to get anywhere, and you're not going to be successful in the other life, you're not successful in this life, you're just going to be miserable. A guy who tries to sit in the cola all day long, and he's not capable of learning, so he ends up, he doesn't get a job, he lives a miserable life, because he doesn't learn, he doesn't have anything. So there's an idea of, like, a guy has to be intelligent about how you live your life, and you have to, you know, it doesn't mean you should short-sell yourself and say, it's not for me. I mean, there is such a thing as pushing yourself and to your limits, but at the same time there are limits. Not every person is capable of the same thing. You know, so I don't think you have to think of yourself, this is a very important point, is that you gotta think of yourself, nothing to do with relative to anybody else. You are you, and you have nothing, your schar and your anything has nothing to do with anybody else. you know? Like, we're used to being brought up in, like, a relative thing. I'm the smartest kid in the class, I'm this kid in the class. Like, ultimately, between you and God, it has nothing to do with anybody else, you know? So you. So you gotta, like, kind of... It's very hard, because that's the world, this is a relative world, but we gotta, like, kind of forget anybody else and just do know what you are, be honest with yourself who you are, and make good decisions in line with your nature, you know? Yeah. So what was I saying? Oh, so the thing with the Nevuah. So that's why I think that Yaakov and Esau... So this is Pshat. So what would have happened if Esau would have gotten the Bechorah? This is very Pshat. This is a nice Pshat. So what would have happened if Esau would have gotten the Bechorah? So he said... Basically, the Nevuah wouldn't... this was Yitzchak's plan, was to give him that bracha. That's what he said. The bracha of being carrying on the mission of Avraham Avinu was something that Yaakov got later on. Not even at that event. It was something which was he got later. And Yitzchak knew he was going to give that to Yaakov. Yaakov was up for grabs. This bracha was the physical. You know, who was going to get the bracha of, like, that God was going to, you know, going to give them the physical goods. You know, the success, the monetary success.
Yeah, that was the bracha?
That was the bracha, yes.
Doesn't sound like the model of
Bethlehem. Well, it's the advice that you should live, that you're going to live that life, and God's going to, the Hashgacha is going to help you as far as you're doing that.
It's not like he points, though, and then God decides this is the guy who gets the physical.
Well, no, it's through the Nevuah that God gives them that advice. That he would, that's the path.
Through Nevuah, he had advice about
how he should live.
To make a living in the world, something like that.
Yes, how he should pursue his life, exactly.
Right, in terms of physical.
Yes.
And that's what he was going to give over.
And he thought he was giving that to Esau.
Right.
But now he said, what would have happened if it turns out Esau went there? So he said that the Nevuah wouldn't have gone through. That's what he said. That basically, he wouldn't have gotten the Nevuah. Because the Nevuah isn't going to give Esau the brachos. It's not. Like, it's like planned on doing
what
that. Oh, he gave it through Nevuah. The brachos were given through Nevuah. At that time, you had Nevuah. That's why he said, bring me the food, so he's going to get in a proper state of mind. So it was the Nevuah. The brachos were through Nevuah. It wasn't just his own chachma, it was through Nevuah. So he had to be in a proper state of mind to be able to give the brachos. And there was the Nevuah. Now the Nevuah would, if Esav were there, God wasn't going to give him a Nevuah to give a bracha to Esav, because Esav didn't deserve the bracha. So what would have happened is basically they just wouldn't have gotten the Nevuah. And then he said Yitzchak would have realized that Esav was the Rele Rasha, and it was a bad plan. And he says, that would have broken Esav. No, I mean, Yitzchak. Like, if he realized that, like, he would have basically been, like, shattered. Like, which he was. You see, like, when he finally realized afterwards, he cried out, like, a crazy, bitter cry, you know? So then, it's possible...
Yitzchak.
I think that's Yitzchak did that, or no, it was Esav. Am I making a mistake?
Esav was the bitter cry, but Yitzchak, I think he says, like...
Who was the one who came and did that, right?
He was definitely scared.
Dan Baruch, yeah, but he was scared. You're right. The cry was a different one. You're right. Yeah, but what did he happen? What happened by him? What? What was that to him? Let's see here. Here we go. One second. It's in here. So Dan has told us. Yeah, Vayerachar Yitzchak Charada Gedola Ad Meod. Charada Gedola Ad Meod. He was a further trembling. So I think he said is like basically what happened was is like he was totally shocked because he realized that apparently Esav wasn't the tzaddik that he thought he was. You know, he realized he was a rasha. So then it could be that he was never going to be able to get Nevuah again. The Nevuah demands a certain type of a state of like simcha. You know, and he was too shaken by that because his whole life was like, you know, like he basically had a great respect for Esav, and it turned out he raised a rasha. You know, so that was like the thing is that he wasn't going to be able to get Nevuah after that point, or he may have not. That was Rivka thought maybe he wasn't going to be able to get Nevuah after that point. So then he wouldn't have been able to get the brachas to Yaakov either, because the brachas were through Nevuah. You know what I mean? So it's like
that's
they knew.
What she had her plan.
That's why she had to make the plan. She knew that if he found that the brachas can't go to Esav. Because that would be bad, or that's not going to happen. But then he's not going to end up giving the brachos to Yaakov. But she knew that they needed the Nevuah to guide him in the proper ideas of the Nevuah. And Nevuah is something that he learned into. Presumably it's not just here to get the good, get the physical good, but it's a lima. There's something which actually expresses ideas in it. You know, so Yaakov understood the bracha, thought into, like a bracha is something you should think into, learn into, study. You know, and presumably that's what the bracha says, you know, in this parasha also. The bracha of Yaakov, he's giving them advice and setting them up in terms of how they should live their life, how the shvatim should set themselves up. And, you know, he's like modeling how the kol shvatim and the kol yisrael should be set up, the dor doros. Yeah?
What does that say about God? Because God's bracha is, I read the English translations, you should recruit a regiment and retreat with it.
Which bracha is that?
God.
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 Not you. I don't know. God's bracha is funny. Studying the brachas is very difficult. I don't plan to do that. It's a good question. Now, some of them are funny and they're hard. And, you know, I'm just kind of talking in a generality. Yeah.
But that fits in with what you're saying, that Yaakov's giving them insight into their
Insight into their strengths, exactly.
You should utilize whatever military...
Exactly. You're a good warrior, you should do that. And Asher, Shemaine, Lachmu, you should have the good borders, and you should whatever, and this, you know, whatever it is. He's giving them insight into how to, you know. But that's, I think, the idea that nowadays, in theory, you could go to Rebbe give you a bracha, but it's basically Rebbe giving you insight into your personality, into how to live your life, and the guidance. And that can be a very powerful thing for a person. But just like as a magical thing of blessing you and somehow giving you powers, that's like an idolatrous thing. What's that?
They wave their wand.
They wave your wand, and then magic happens. Yeah, no, that's definitely, that's a non-Jewish idea. But, like everything in Torah is taken out of, abused. Yeah. Okay. Someone else? Question?
I already asked my question.
That was just your first one, I thought. You know, you can decide. That was the warm-up.
So, I have notes, from last time.
Oh, yeah?
What was it?
Okay. You got a good one or no? Check the notes. If not, I got something to talk about. No pressure.
I don't know if I asked the one with Yisroel or Avram, who had more schus, because Yisroel tried out
the other religions. Right.
Avram just knew right away. So people always give him.
Right. Well, Avram's dad, he grew up as an idolater. Avram, really.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just that he worshipped. Tom says he worshipped with them when he was a kid.
They don't tell you that. They say he broke them.
Yeah, he broke them. But at first, it's when he was a kid. But then he started thinking about it and he realized. But maybe Avram's not the best model. It doesn't have to be. You could just pick Yitzchak. And you have to send your questions back on, right?
I mean, you say Yitzchak because Avram did.
Yeah, right. That's your question. Now, isn't your question, this is Yisro who tried out everything and then came to God, or someone who was born into it? Isn't that your question?
Yeah, but...
That's not really
more question. Avram because like, he...
Oh, I see what you mean. You mean Avram found it naturally, and Yisro found it by searching. But that's what, I think Avram searched. It's just that he didn't have to try all the different gods in order to do it. He just kind of, it seems like he somehow went straight for the truth. I mean, he did grow up in the house of idolatry, and he was involved in that, but it seems like pretty young he kind of started gravitating towards the truth. Whereas it seemed Yisro somehow had to do his research. It would seem to be Avram was greater in theory, I think, because his mind, the person could be such a mind that they just kind of, like in a different, an area of thought. Like one guy could just have a mind that gravitates to the truth and sees it, another guy will end up there, but it may take him a bunch of steps. They go this way, it doesn't work out. They go this way, that doesn't work out. This way, that doesn't work out. In any area, things are like that, So it would seem to be the guy who manages to go right to it is going to be his greater, a greater mind, a greater ability, right? Aliza? Give me 1 second. Ezra's beeping on the phone. You want it? 371-9594. Yeah.
It's basically on the test. Like, Yisro did it through trial and error.
Exactly. Right. So they both end up with the same answer, and they're both, bottom line, you get it. But it would seem to be the greater one is the guy who could just go straight to the answer. Yeah, for sure. It would seem so. It's an interesting question, though. But again, though, I'd say is that, that question of greater is that coming up, that relative thing again, It's like, ultimately, they each get their star, But it's a fair question, though, yeah. Fine.
So,
So, I have, can we go over, the locals of how to interact with, Goyim? Or, is that so, like, what kind of...
What do you gotta do? You gotta steal? You gotta buy?
No, not that. Beat them up? Beat them up? Smash their faces?
What are you allowed to do?
That's the only
thing. How are you supposed to interact with them?
Be nice.
You love not safe.
That's a good question.
I would say that depends on how many other people are watching you.
Yeah, there's a thing of the Chil Hashem and the fight, you know, creating fights and
y'all
stuff.
But that. Nobody's gonna find out.
Quickly take off your yarmulke.
What would be the problem with saving him?
Saving him? Well, in theory, the problem is like, I don't really know the halachas exactly. Oh, well, that's one problem, is if you're going to kill yourself. That's one issue, which is an important issue. But even if not, there is a question. Let's say, for instance, let's just say a guy's a Rasha, right? So you know a guy's a Rasha. So then would you say a problem to save him?
That's a Jew,
that
can apply to
the
Jewish
or non-Jew. Or non-Jew. I mean, it's like some guy's idolater or something, you know? So liquid is a mitzvah to kill. You know, that's the thing we say. It's like, in the time of Eretz Yisrael, there's a mitzvah to destroy, to kill all the idolaters, to kill the Shevolimos, you know, like when we went to Eretz Yisrael. But after that, there's no mitzvah to kill idolaters. Even if you know a guy's an idolater and you know he's a Rasha. And, yeah, a guy or a Jew could be a Rasha, but you don't have to be Jewish or a Rasha. Right, so that's what I think the halacha though is. I think that's the halacha is that nowadays you don't kill them. Like a guy's an idolater or something like that. A guy's an idolater. Because guy's chayav keep shavim esmei enough. Because a guy and goyim also. The Torah has a life for goyim also. The Torah doesn't just say, Torah's for Jews and goyim, forget about that. The Torah says, no. There's a plan for goyim also. They have to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu and they have to keep shavim esmei enough. And we guide them. Not only do they have to, it's our responsibility to teach them. And as you're asking how to relate to them, we should teach them. Teach them ideas. Teach them the Shev Mishnei Noach. Teach them the philosophy of the Torah. Teach them the proper way of life. The Derech HaChaim of a Jew could be the same Derech HaChaim of a guy. You know, there's Mashneiros has a friend who's a guy, and he learns with him. I think he has a chavrusa with him maybe on a regular basis. Sean, right? They hang out. What?
Yeah,
you have a chavrusa? You said with him. You know, he's a guy, and he teaches Shev Mishnei Noach, and he learns. You know, he learns the areas of Torah which are much for him to learn. And he learns, he lives the lifestyle of Torah. He just doesn't have the halachic system. So, but the basic philosophy, the basic way of life, you can have whether you're Jewish or a guy. So we should teach them. Teach them Torah. Teach them what's mitzvah to teach them.
Does that answer the question of how you're supposed to...
There's different goyim. I mean, you can't just group all goyim together. So the goy who's interested in learning and is interested in understanding, then how should you treat him in the same way as you treat a Jew? You should teach him... Teach him, be kind to him. He's another fellow person, human being, and someone like him, and you should be a mekayer from to the ideas of the Torah. But then you can talk about a guy who's a Rasha, or who's an Ovid, or a Zara, or something to that. You know, then the halacha is that there's no mitzvah to kill of the Zara, but in Eretz Yisrael, and a kind of Eretz Yisrael. But I think that it says, is lo ma'ilim v'lo maridim. It means you don't kill them, but you don't save them. Because we hold this, like, really a guy is chayav to keep the Torah, and if not, he's in a certain sense chayav misa. He violates Shem Mitzvah, chayav misa. But we don't, when we have our ultimate society in Eretz Yisrael, we kill we do that. We actually execute people who aren't keeping the system. But now that's not our, we're not in that position, and that's not the mitzvah. But at the same time, we're not going to save them because they're really Rasham, and we hold that they're living corrupt lives. And the same way we do, you know, Jews, who's a Rasha, we would kill in a Bezdin, or we wouldn't save, he's a Rasha. So same thing with the guy, that's the case. You know, but I don't know you figure, you know.
So then, if you had, let's say you had the case where there was a Jew who was in danger of dying.
If he's a Rasha?
And you know he killed somebody.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's...
You know he committed murder. Let's make it clear. He committed murder.
But murder is different than...
That's what I'm saying. We're not going to say he killed him. He committed murder. He is a murderer.
Right. But I don't know if the whole...
And he's dying.
Right.
Do you save him?
I don't know. I think you may.
It might just be a luck.
It could be a luck. Yeah, it could be a luck. But I think a guy is not part of Klai Yisrael, like a Min or an Abikoros, I think you don't. I think an Abikoros you don't. But a Min, but a guy for doing a crime, there's a difference between an Avera, which is an action, and an idea where the guy's life is like he's an Abikoros and he's like a total worthless guy.
Okay, but I was just going for a guy who deserves Klai
Yisrael. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. I'm not sure. I mean, you have to look at Nalachos. I don't know Nalachos fan. But I'm saying that's, I think, the attitude of the guy. A goy is no different than a Jew, but it's an Ovid of Odazara, or it's the based on what, who, you know, the type of person that he is.
So what about atheists? Self-deification?
Yeah, that's the same type of thing. But I don't know Nalachos.
Like,
same thing. What?
Is atheism?
It's not about Odazara, but it's the same type of thing. It's a guy, you know. It's not really Odazara. He's not worshipping anything. Yeah, I'm sorry, Matthew.
How do we use the term Russia? What is that?
Russia?
What's the level? Like, it's just supposed to be that doesn't keep all the mitzvahs they're supposed to do?
No, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, I'm using it in a very loose way, but. No, it doesn't mean that. I mean, there's a halachic shame, Russia. You mean in a Jew or a guy, or both?
Yeah, either one, I guess.
Well, a guy, I think the halacha is that he's chayav misa when he violates any of the seven mitzvahs. But I don't know if they call. I think he's called a Rasha, you know, when he does that, because his life is like his ticket to life is basically he keeps shoving mitzvahs. But in a Jew, I mean, he's involved in talking mitzvahs because he do any of eros, doesn't mean you're Rasha, you know.
It seems like a very theoretical term when you speak of.
I know, but there are halachic in nafkaminas. But I think, for instance, in certain contexts, a guy who violates a law, he's a Rasha, like halachically he's a Rasha. But I don't know if it's, but. It's a good. It's true. It's really. It's a loose word. I'm using it in a loose way.
Really?
Yeah. No. It's a good point.
It violates one law.
I think so. And that's what it says when you. Yeah. The man ben hakos a rasha. The guy stayed malchus, and then nekolchicha. Once you hit him, he becomes a kapara, and he's not a rasha. But there's levels of rishos. So that's why I don't think the term always means the same thing. You know. Yeah, Isaac.
If the one who believes in Christianity would be considered.
Idolater?
Yeah.
Yeah. Believes, yeah, probably. That's a question, but because they basically they hold a human being as a god.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There's a mistake. There's some make a mistake in the Tosa. They think he holds that it's not, but the Tosa. There's some say Tosa says it's not of Abzar, but it's a mistaken read of his Eidi show. It's a mistaken reading in the Tosa. Yeah. No. It's not that. It's a mistaken reading in the Tosa. He says. Like, goyim aren't, there's no issa for a goy to swear on their god or something. Or when it's like a trinity or something like that. Whatever.
Isn't there an issa to swear on the false god?
There is, but not for the goyim. And it says goyim aren't mitzvah on that or something. So there's a way to read it that it sounds like he's saying it's not of Odazara.
It's
not that it's not of Odazara, it's just that it's not whatever. So I forget
the exact. So it's just a thing for a Jew to cause them to swear on their
god. Yeah, right, okay. But basically, yeah, that's also an idolatry. Yeah, but Islam isn't.
Right.
Islam isn't. The Rambam says Islam isn't. Because they have one God. You know, I mean, they have other corrupt things, you know, whatever, but, you know. But, the idea of three gods and the idea of physical, is human God. I mean, there's nothing, you know, more idolatrous than a human God.
Yeah. Well, at least Islam.
Yeah, I think the Muslims aren't so bad.
It has the fundamental.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
they're
yeah.
Time for more questions?
Yeah, sure.
We're talking about like thinking about yourself like, in a relative way.
Yes.
Other people versus like as like your own person.
Yeah.
So like, do you have any advice? It's very hard, but just like, do you have any advice how to like
how to do that?
About it, like, and I feel like at different times we all seem like I like that kind of thinking can be painful to a person. Like kind of thinking about yourself more as your own person and like doing activities that are good for you. Versus activities that you think might like make you better relative to other people, making about yourself in a relative way compared to other people, and doing things that might make you a better person in that framework versus
having a crappy job to become a millionaire.
Yeah, right, exactly. And maybe our society values like investment bankers, so you're going to become an investment bank, but like, you're going to be miserable working 100-hour weeks.
Right, or just in general, that idea of pushing yourself to be the better, like the other guy. But you're not the other guy, and you have to evaluate yourself. That's what we were saying. You have to do what's
yeah,
for you.
Especially comparing yourself.
Comparing yourself to other people and feeling like you feel depressed because you're not like that guy, or he's doing that, or whatever. What?
Like, everything.
Yeah, yeah, with everything. Yeah, so that's what he's saying. It's like, it's a nice theory to say that you're your own person, you have nothing to do with anybody else. But, like, bottom line is like, how do you get out of that trap? Because it's so natural to feel that way, and...
It's harmful.
Yeah, harmful and stressful, and, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you don't necessarily want to keep up with everybody else because you can't.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, it's a painful thing. It's like keeping up with the Joneses. Yeah, you just gotta, you do stupid things. Like, you have to make a nice wedding because everyone else is doing it and you can't afford it. I mean, the society is involved in all these types of things. It's a big rat race and it's a big competition with everybody else. And your goal in life is to be better than the next guy. You know, but it doesn't do anything to be better than the next guy. Ultimately, who really cares? You die, you have nothing to do with you. The next guy. The question is, what are you? Who cares about the next guy? You're you, he's him, is, you know, whatever is your...
Sometimes it becomes a problem.
Sometimes you get so wrapped up in it that, like, you'll often, like we're saying before, you'll oftentimes pick the activity that will make you look better in the eyes of other people versus something that will...
Actually be better for you and make you happy.
Yeah,
right, it's true.
You can't even see better than, like, making you more happy. Yeah?
Right, because you get so caught up.
Because, like, now you passed up that opportunity.
That's a
good question. Now you're, like, younger in the eyes of other people. That's
true. Right. So the question is, how do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know if there's, like, one route, just saying it's very general advice.
Okay, that's a good question. Any thoughts? How do you do it? His question is, how do you break out of the looking at yourself in a relative sense and, you know, make doing things that are truly good for you and not just competing with the other guy and try, you know, sometimes you do things which are harmful to yourself because you're busy competing with everybody else. You don't end up, you know, thinking into what's really going to make you happy or what's really going to be good for you. You're just worried about how you're going to appear to other people. And first of all, how they think of you, and then how you think of yourself relative to them, right? It's not only how they think of you, it's how you think of yourself, because you feel, you judge yourself in a relative way as compared with everybody else. So how do you get out of that? Because it's kind of like so ingrained in our nature since we're a kid. Everyone's always comparing us to everybody else. Non-judgmental community? Okay, that's true. I mean, there are certain societies which are worse than others in that regard, right?
Yeah.
That's true. That's true.
First you gotta figure out what you want.
Yeah.
That's the first step, okay?
Well, right, that's true.
Find out what you really want.
Right. That's a good point. That's a very good first step, is what I would say. It's like, insofar as you don't have a clear idea of what you think is good for you and what you want and what's true and what's real, so then you're basically going to go with what everyone says. Because there's a world says, yeah, everyone says that the main thing is to have as much money as you possibly could have. Now, if you don't have a clear idea that that's not really true and that's not your ultimate meaning in life, then everyone else is saying it. So you're going to believe them, and that's basically becomes what society tells you. So now you got to, if you don't want to be pulled into that, the very first you have to basically think into what your values are and have a clear, not just because the Torah says so, like, you got to kind of think about these things and understand then why is it not giving me ultimate happiness to just have as much money as I possibly could have? Why is it that a life of knowledge is going to make me happier and give me a better life? You know, like, why, well, you have to, like, you can't just, insofar as you're just going with what people tell you, then you're not really going to be able to stand strong and avoid the tide and avoid everyone's over the pole. But insofar, the first step is to really know what you want, but not just to know in theory, to understand and to think into it and to really learn about why what you hold to be true is really true and is good for you. And then, that's a first step.
Who says he knows what's good for him? I mean, even like Jewish communities, we build off of like help from other people and people that are more knowledgeable or have like a more objective viewpoint than like we could in a certain situation. So, I don't know how. I mean, I sometimes feel like we're not the best ones to make decisions. I mean, it's good. I mean, it's good. You're saying it's a situation where he knows what he wants, and that's it. To say that's the best thing necessarily for him.
Well, maybe the best thing with him, for him to understand that could be part of the thing, is for him to decide. That's another thing. He could say, listen, I'm in a position where I can't decide for myself, but therefore I have to rely on what my rabbi tells me is the best thing for me. But then he has to see that that's the case also. He has to know that he has to listen to his rabbi. He's still, ultimately, you can't help but making your own decision. Your decision might be to listen to your rabbi, but then the rest of the society is not listening to their rabbi, they're listening to Hollywood. So you have to know why it's good for you to listen to your rabbi or listen to whoever it is that you listen to, you know? But ultimately you can't just say, I'm just going to listen. There's a million people to listen to. So you're going to have to think into, well, this rabbi is a guy who's so-and-so and so-and-so and he really makes sense to me. You can't, you know, ultimately you have to go make a decision in your life, even if it means to follow somebody.
Right.
You're going to have to...
But it's still relative.
Well, not exactly. See, relative means is like you're judging yourself as your success and your success in life, so to speak. Success is a vague word, but your success in life is as how good I am compared to somebody else. You know, and you're trying to outdo other people. So that's like there's no reality to that. No, you are what you are. And whether there's another guy, if you get to a certain point in your life, whether your friend is a little better than you or less than you, it doesn't affect what you are. You are what you are. It's just a psychological thing. In your head, you compare yourself to the other guy. But whether the other guy exists or doesn't exist or is better or less or whatever, you are what you are. It doesn't make any difference, you know, and you are as happy as, you know, but... Somehow you judge yourself and you get caught in this thing of where you measure yourself not based on objectively what your life is and whether you're happy and what you have, what you need, or whether you're living a good life, you know, in terms of objective terms, but based upon yourself as compared with other people. You know, that's what we're talking
right.
about.
And it seems like even like appreciation, when we talk about like appreciation for ourselves, not even talking about like, you know, like going up, but even it's always like comparing someone that is less than us, even.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like the idea exactly. More, exactly.
But,
right.
Like, you know, like,
exactly. Yeah. Appreciation also should be, what do I have? I have this. I have that. Right. I have that. Forget it. I mean, not more, not less, not anything. You know.
Yeah, no,
but it's just like, you know, it's actually interesting. This tonight, my son had last night, my daughter had a sleepover with one of her friends. You know. So now, apparently, my son was upset about it. I don't know. I didn't get the whole backstory, but he didn't want it. So now tonight, he got a sleepover. You know. But then he found out that my daughter had another sleepover also tonight. So it's like, so he was so upset. But he's like, you're going for the sleepover, what's the problem? You know, but she also gets one, and she was supposed to, and she got one last night. So it's like, what do you care? You're getting what you want, you know? But it's like, he's a kid, but this is what kids are, you know? It's like, ah, it's normal for a kid. But it's like, he was so upset because in the relative framework, like, you know, you think, it's like, what's the difference, really? Like, you're getting what you want. What more do you want? What do you need? It's like part of the way you measure yourself is based upon, in a comparative sense, to the other. Yes, you want. Exactly. Exactly. So the idea is, like, a person's general thing since we're kids is to beat your sibling, and to beat your sibling becomes your friend, and to beat your neighbor, and to beat the Joneses, and to beat whatever it is. And your whole life, it's all about beating other people as opposed to, and that's something, the point is, you got to grow up at a certain point and realize, forget anybody else, just me. What's good for me? So I'm not saying, yeah, maybe good for you is to listen to your rabbi, whatever. I'm not saying don't listen to other people, but you have to take a step back and say, what is my life and what is a good life for me? You know, not because I want to be better than somebody else or different than anybody, whatever. What's the right life for me? And you have to make a decision on that. It might mean, look, ultimately I think there's a person who grows up, they could understand even the Torah, why the Torah is actually good for them. Not every person could do that. But a person, at least on a basic level, could understand why it is that he should be listening to a rabbi. Why is that the way that you should do it, as opposed to listening to some, you know, some Hollywood actor who tells you whatever, or some rich guy who says money is the way to go. There's a lot of competing things. So insofar as you don't really think into what's really good for you, so then you're just going with the flow, then you're going to be living in this relative world where society tells you what's really good. You know, and that's like the problem is we're stuck in a world where society tells us what success means. You know, that's part of the problem of being in Gaulis. It's like society tells us what it means to be successful. So let's say successful means to work like a dog and make as much money as you possibly could. So now, it's very hard for a person to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to be happy with a little bit less money than I possibly could because I want to have some time to be able to learn and to be able to devote some time to my family and to learning and to understanding and to knowledge. I think I'm going to kind of take a lesser job. You know, it's like something society thinks you're crazy. What's wrong with you? You know, so it's a very strong force in a person's life. So you end up you could become like a slave to what society demands of you because they think you're a jerk if you don't do it. They don't understand. You know. And that's terrible because you can end up, you become a slave, and then the time you die and you realize, oh man, I just wasted my life. I didn't do anything productive because I was busy being a slave. So you have to come to a point where a person has to think into their own life and forget what everyone else is telling them, and make a decision as what do you really think is good for you. You know, you have to do some soul searching and figure that out. But every person has, if you don't do that, society's going to force you into something. So you got to just decide where you're going to go with, you know.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you said both sides, that like, not people could think that, I don't care what people think, but it's also how you see yourself, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
But I feel like almost everybody, like, looks up to somebody in some way, mm-hmm. for some advice.
Right.
So I think it's also important to just, like, truly look up to somebody to see.
Yeah, right. But then you have to decide who's the guy, who's that guy, you know, because there's going to be a lot of guys, and naturally you have a lot of different guys who you feel that way to. But then you kind of have to decide, well, there are five different guys, they're all very different. Who do I really think is something that is me, and what do I value, what do I really, you know? And the more you're confident about that, and the more you understand why that is, I think the more you'll be able to avoid the pull of the society. The more you understand your choice of life, and the path that you're on, the more I think you'll be able... Like, if you are convinced that the life of like, working like a dog and making $1 billion is not the happy, is not going to make you happy, if you're really convinced of that, like, you really see the idea. Because it's not easy, but if you see it, then I think you'll be able to handle the social pressure to do that. Even if your parents' friends may ask you, oh, what are you doing? You say, oh, I'm learning, and they'll be like, you know, roll their eyes or whatever. But like, if you really see if you see that they're the ones who are like involved slaves to this thing, and you see clearly that it's a fake, then you'll be able to. You may feel a little bit of pressure, but at the same time, the more knowledge you have that that's a scam and that you see what you're doing, you're convinced of what you're doing, the more you'll be able to tolerate that pressure. You know, so that's what I think is that the relative sense is the more knowledge you gain, I think the more knowledge you gain and think into what you're doing, the more you'll be able to rise to an objective level and get out of the social relative sense, you know? So I don't know if it's kind of like a thing that comes along with your growth. I don't know if there's like necessarily a trick to...
It's hard too, because the things that affect like your very value system also.
Yeah.
Even if there was kind of nobody else around, or not, even if you didn't like actually compare yourself to any other given person, but like the whole thing just...
You mean you're judging of yourself?
Right. Like, it affects your values. Then
yeah, can you give me an example of what you mean?
Like, let's say, like, we're saying that, like, people value in general, like an ethic of hard work or something.
Right.
Let's say you only work 4 hours a day, but everybody else around you is working 2.
Yeah.
So, like, you might feel good about yourself because you work more than anybody else, but, like, oftentimes I feel like you'll still feel bad because everybody says you should be working 10 hours a day. You know what I mean? Because like, it has affected your value system so much.
Right. I mean, it makes its way into your system.
Right.
But I think, again, the more you have knowledge and the more you could think into these things and assess them in truth, and make a fair, honest assessment in a way that's convincing to you, the more you'll be able to avoid the sway of the emotion, because you'll realize it's just an emotional thing, and you see it's not true, you see it's a lie, it's just telling you something which isn't really true. So the more you actually see why your emotion is tricking you, so then you'll be able to ignore it, you know. But insofar as you kind of believe it, so then you're going to end up being influenced by it, you know what I mean? So I think you have to see the idea clearly, think into whatever it's telling you, and see, you know, call it out. You know what I mean? We're kind of talking generalities here, but...
I think it's a coming-of-age thing?
Sort of. I think, look, to a certain extent, because the kids are kids, you know? So, I mean, I think... I don't think, look, there are adults who are still kids in that sense. It's definitely not something that... I just think, like, when you're in high school, you just can't... It's not normal for a person in high school to be able to, like, think like that. But as you get a little bit older, I think you start being able to, you know, be a little bit more mature and think into your life and realize you're growing up and you have to make a decision for how, you know, you have to live your life. You know, like in high school, you're kind of just going with the flow.
It's interesting, like, in high school, it's very important. It's very, like, important how you guide your life. It's interesting, like, how those years, like, you might not be mature enough to make those decisions.
I know. It's important. You mean, you can live with consequences of the decisions you make in high school, unfortunately. I know. That's what you just got to hope. Someone once told me that. Recently told me that they advise some kids or whatever, like, you know, you could, someone was like advising some high school kids, it's like, you could really make decisions now that could like highly impact your future, you know, and like for the bad or for the good, just like be really careful, you know, because like you don't realize it, like when you're a high school kid, you don't realize these things, but sometimes you get stuck on a bad path and then you're doomed, you know, pretty much. So hopefully, you know, you got to hope that you don't, you know, that doesn't happen to you. But, you know, but still, you know, a lot of things are undoable and are, you know, you could get out of. I mean, if you, you know. But I think there comes a point where you're at, you know, high school, it's like kind of, you're not, you're more still under your parents' roof, or so to speak. And there comes an age where you're starting to go from being, like, just, like, under your parents to moving towards adulthood and towards being an individual and, like, setting up your life. Like, you're starting to think about what you're going to do with yourself and how you're going to live and are you going to get married. And, you know, I don't know, just, like, you kind of left to start living for yourself and realizing, okay, my parents are this, and maybe I accept what my parents say, maybe I don't. I mean, you know, ultimately, you know, you start growing up, you start becoming independent, you have to decide how you're going to live. So, you know, it's definitely, but most, you know, just because you get older doesn't mean you actually become mature, but it kind of takes, I think, you know, age sometimes. Yeah?
I'm just wondering why everything has to be dependent on high school when that's your sort of age when people like to fool around.
Yeah.
I was saying, like, it could be that that's just their way of coping with stress at that time, but it seems to me that they're still immature and they shouldn't, and the life decisions they make at that point should not be what people base the rest of their life on.
No.
It should be when they're more mature.
Yeah, but in those circles, that's like, that's around the time that things start to change.
That's when they start to change, but you should be making your decisions when you have fully completed your transition into being an adult.
That could be like in your 30s.
What's your point, Chaim? I don't hear your point exactly.
So my point is, why are you making their whole life ride on when they're immature and they can't
make the I'm not making it. I'm saying sometimes, like, you could associate yourself with a certain group of friends and you could kind of go down certain paths that are very hard to break away from. You know, let's say a guy becomes addicted to drugs when he's 14 years old. Right? High, severely addicted. It's very hard for him to, at 18 years old, to say, you know what, I forget drugs. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, it would be nice if it would, but, you know, it's not just not an easy thing for a person to do. And now your whole life could be stuck being, you know, you could have your whole life could be like overcoming your addiction for your entire life because you made bad decisions when you're 14 years old. You know, now when you're 14 years old, it's like, is that, and it could be when you're 11 years old. Now, is that really in your control or whatever, you know? So, like, it depends. Hopefully you don't get into bad situations like that where you basically, you know, most things aren't like that, but there are things like that where a person could kind of get a certain group of friends, a certain group of whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But that is an extreme situation. I think you're right. In general, you know, kid in high school is in high school, and whatever you do in high school, you know, you get older, you get out of high school, and basically, assuming you didn't get, like, stuck in something like that, usually you can basically just, you know, like you live your life and whatever that was high school you did in high school is kind of, you know, the past. In general, you're right. I think you are right. It's like you're mature and whatever. Everyone, you know. You wouldn't be able to tell. You see a guy who's 25 years old, you have no idea what he's doing.
But nowadays, it's like
you
need to get into the right high school to get into the right college.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. No, I'm not saying that. No, I think the point is, right, that was your point, Yaakov. Now that you can just sometimes you can get stuck in bad paths when you're in high school. And you're, yeah, and unfortunately, it's more prevalent nowadays. So, you know, like these trouble, at-risk youth things, and these types of things are pretty common. And it becomes, I mean, it's terrible to see. I mean, I've seen, you know, cases, guys who are really in bad shape because of, you know, like drugs, especially when you're a kid. It's just not so easy to just stop these things. You know, really, your whole life could be stuck with them.
Not necessarily just taking drugs either.
No, it's everything.
sale of a drug?
Yeah.
The buying, the selling.
Overseas?
Yeah.
Sometimes you can just buy it, not to use it.
Yeah.
What is the translation or definition of emuna?
Emuna. Good question.
I don't know, it's going to be like, it's too long or anything, but just like.
Yeah.
You got it.
In what sense? Where it's used when?
I don't know. What does it mean to really have?
Right. What does it mean to really have emunah? Yeah. Let's take it next time. One question. I don't want to. What? Okay. Yeah. Keep it down. Keep your notes.
I got it.
Yeah, I'll pass. It's a good question. I just don't want to rush it. It's, you know, that could be like a bigger discussion. You know, I just feel like we'll just be a quick answer. Yeah. Any short questions? Or should we break? Yeah. Okay, so we didn't get to your question, Matt. So that'll be like our background question if we ever want to take it up.
Yeah, that's not such a good question.
So. No, okay. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. So think of questions. I mean, this is, you know, again, I have this stuff prepared, but, you know, I think it's really important in general for people, you know, for guys to be able to, like, really, you know, pick up what's bothering you or what you want to know about Torah is, you know. So. Yeah, Sammy.
Maybe for, I don't know if it's a short question, but maybe for another time, but based on the discussion we were having about not basing your life based on other people,
yes,
people and relative decision-making, it sounded like we were assuming that, rightfully, that the goal that we're kind of looking for is being happy.
Okay.
But I mean, at least when I grew up, I'm assuming in general, people are told that the best life for you, the happiest life, is going to be that whatever is going to give you the most olam haba. But, like, it didn't really sound like we were talking about it like that, because, like we were saying, let's say the guy that just can't learn all day or something like that, that kind of lifestyle isn't going to give him the most olam haba.
Right.
Just the fact that working all day and learning an hour a night as opposed to learning 10 hours during the day is just not... it's not going to be comparable in terms of olam haba. So when we say happiness, like, what are we really talking about? Like,
right. You mean, what's the goal here?
Yeah, it's the goal.
But you're saying it's an olam haba. I don't think that... my point with that guy is, if a guy tries to learn 10 hours a day, he's not going to get one olam haba either. Because he's not going to be able to do it. He's just not... the guy who's not cut out for it is just going to sit in the basement of Rush, miserable, spacing out, drinking coffee, going to the bathroom, going, playing with his phone. It's just like a guy, not your average guy, just can't do it. So he's not getting more olam haba by trying to be the guy who learns 10 hours a day. If he's not the guy, he's not getting olam hazeh or olam haba. He's just, he's a wasted, miserable life. He's just, he's not, the guy you gotta know who could do that. If you could do it, then great, sit and learn the Beis Medrash for 10 hours a day, and that's who you are. But if you're not cut out for it, then what are you doing? You're not going to get anything. At least go out and get a job and learn. You'll be able to learn 1 hour. That guy who tries to learn 10 hours, he's going to learn nothing. If he just got a job and learned 1 hour at night, he'd be able to learn an hour. You know, so you got to be honest with yourself. Is what's, you try to do too much, you end up getting nothing. You know, so you have to be, the best olam haba will be for you also to go out to work. That's kind of my point. It's like you got to be real. Torah is just to be real to who you are, and you can't fit into some cookie cutter mold of like what you're supposed to be. You got to be realistic with yourself and where you could be. Maybe you could start off learning 1 hour, and then you could really love learning in that 1 hour. Maybe you could do an hour and a half the next year. Maybe you'll end up after 30 years learning 2 hours. Maybe, who knows? Maybe you'll end up learning 7 hours. I mean, but today, what are you able to do in a realistic way? And you have to hold yourself up to a goal which is reasonable for you. You know, and only you can know. I mean, I don't think it's a person who's selling themselves short by saying I can only learn an hour when they could do more, but at the same time, to feel like, I think a lot of people feel a pressure to be like someone who their Rebbe wants them to be like. You know, and it's not really realistic and it's not reasonable to demand that of them. Not every person could do that. So, the guy can't, just not going to be able to do it. So you have to, you know, each person has to be able to. The Torah is for everybody. Not everybody is not a chacham. There's an am, and there's amon am, and amon am has the Torah on their level. So for olam haba also, olam and olam hazeh, it's the same thing. It's going to be the same thing. I mean, we could talk about what happiness means, but happiness is a good life. A life of Torah will give you the happiest life in this world and in the world to come. And there's not going to be any discrepancy about what's going to make you be happier in this life and in the world to come. Happier in this life is a life which is in line with truth and reality and knowledge. And that's going to make you happy. And so far as you're living a life of fantasies and distortions, and you're going to be unhappy. And then all my boss, the same thing. And that's what the Torah is saying. So it's not asking you to do anything which is not going to make you happy in this world also. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know if that's, maybe we can take it up further, but yeah. See, I think as a kid, religion, no one would believe you. If you told a kid the Torah is going to make you happy, they think you're joking. Like, well, no way, come on. You know, it's religion, not only a kid, most adults, because The idea of religion is like you're sacrificing yourself and making yourself miserable for God. That's the religious, idolatrous idea. Like you're sacrificing yourself for the sake of God, to help God out. But Torah doesn't hold that whole idea is alien to Torah. That's idolatry. You can't help God out. God, the Torah is a tov lach, it's for you. And the Torah, God is knows you, and He's giving you the life which is best for you. So everything in the Torah, which may be painful, is short-term painful, long-term good for you and happy. You know, just like you don't, when you're a kid, like you can't tell the kid do what makes you happy. Because the kid that thinks what makes them happy is to just do stupid things. You know, so like you can't necessarily tell a kid that this is the truth. You kind of have to slowly as you grow up, make him explain to him, let him realize that this is actually what's going to be good for you. Not for tomorrow, for your long-term life, this is what's going to make you happy. You know, but for a kid, they kind of have to say, oh, mom, the kid doesn't even understand that sitting and learning all day is going to be happy. You know, you tell your kid, I love learning. I can tell my kids, you know, they ask what do you want to do or what's fun or, you know, let's say learning. It's a joke. You know, they can't get that. They know that I do it and apparently I believe it and whatever, but they don't. They can't even understand that. That could even make any sense to a kid. So now the Torah tells you to do that and to control yourself into this and to that. So you got to be a little more mature to be able to understand why these things are actually going to make you happy. You know? So as a kid, they say, oh, Allah. But when you get older, you realize, oh, so I'm not all my the same exact thing. You know?
So I guess it's for the average Joe. Let's say just working alone, you're saying like that lifestyle wouldn't make him happy, and learning just alone wouldn't make him happy.
Right. Exactly. A balance. Right. For your average guy, a balance is going to make him happy. He has a job, he supports his family, he's a productive member of society, he learns all the knowledge, he has a perspective of who he is and the proper ideas about God and about his life, and he's living in a realistic sense of what's, you know, in line with who he is. And that's what's going to make him happy in this life. And, you know, if he's working all day, he's not going to be happy. He realizes he's empty. It's an empty life. He sits and learns all day, he's not going to be able to do it. It's not for him. You know, so this is what's going to make him happiest. And that's going to be the best alamba for him, because that's what he is. You can't be something else. That's who you are.
Right. So then, I guess I'm asking about the guy who, let's say, can learn 8 hours a day and something like that.
Okay.
Work through, I don't know, whatever.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, he's kind of balanced, but like he's really shifting it towards the learning.
Okay.
And he can do it, but he's gonna be miserable. He's gonna be unhappy. But he can do it. He can learn.
So why is he gonna be unhappy? But then I'm saying he can't do it. It depends what you mean. I mean, then he can't, because you can't learn if you're miserable about it. You're not going to be able to do it. I mean, he could force himself to do it for like a year, because he's, you know, and so long as Rebbe's looking over his shoulder.
That's what I'm saying. That's the societal pressure. Just, they force that, because they're strong. The societal pressures are really strong.
Oh.
People do a lot.
Yeah, I know, but you can force you to sit down, but they're not going to force you to focus. Learning doesn't just mean sitting in the base medrash. So society could pressure you to sit in the base medrash, but they can't just pressure you to actually be productive and being learning. And a lot of guys who just sit in the base medrash and don't learn.
Right, I'm saying, like, the guys who cruise, it's like, this guy's learning.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Like, you know, there's no way around. Like,
so why is he miserable?
He's just not, I don't know, like, if you take him to a psychologist, it'll come out that he's just really unhappy. He's very upset, he's very frustrated. He pushes it down. Like, that's the thing. Like, guys are unhappy with people.
Yeah, that's true. That's, I think, a psychological problem, though.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
but you got who has a psychological problem? No, I don't think so. Then he can't handle it. Then he can't really do it. That's not what I mean to do it. I mean, he's able to do it doesn't mean he's physically able to do it. I mean, he's able to do it, and the total of you doing Torah properly, it should make you happy. And if you don't, it means it's something in your psyche, you can't really do it. Now, you could by force, if a guy has a gun to you, whatever, he could force you to do it, but that's not what I mean by really doing it.
That's not learning Torah.
No, I mean really learning Torah means living the life of Torah in a way which it's really part of you and you're happy about it. You know, it's like a forced thing. And look, it's been social abolishment. Sometimes by doing it, he has resistances and he'll overcome them through doing it. That sometimes happens. So, you know, of course, the beginning, these things are painful. That's why I would think normally that guy's going to end up being happy. If he's really learning, he's going to love it. I mean, if you're really involved in learning, it's just enjoyable. So he's learning 8 hours a day, and he's enjoying it, and he's loving it, then why is he miserable? You know, I just don't see the guy, unless the guy really has some sort of unconscious problem. But that's a different thing. That's, you know, that's the guy has an issue. You know, he has to go to a psychologist and figure out his problem.
Right.
You know, in the ordinary condition, a guy who's actually really able to be involved in the Chachma of Torah 8 hours a day, how's he not happy about that? Yeah, but it could be I'm oversimplifying things. Yeah.
I guess it's kind of possible if you're just like doing the kiosk all day.
Like, yeah, that's what I don't. That's what I'm saying. I don't mean that. I mean really involved in the Chachma.
Right.
That's what I mean by learning. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good, fellas. So I guess we continue. So you know, you're welcome to join us, and you know, we usually do this Saturday nights, but you know. Yeah, so you're in Yeshiva now, is that the deal?
I'm in YBT, I think.
Officially.
Still have to pay.
So what happened? So you were in Israel for, where were you? You were in Israel, you just didn't like it or something?
So I went to an Israeli Yeshiva, and it was great. It was not for me, eventually. It was that you had to learn. It was just like,
and you did.